Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I, as always, am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and joining me, as always, my two cohorts, Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hi.
Hi. Nick Newman, a little less enthusiastic than Danny, but we're all here nonetheless, so let's get going. Today, during our feature review segment, we will be talking about the film Zero Dark Thirty by director Catherine Bigelow and writer Mark Boll. Before that, we will be having a brief movie topic discussion. Today we'll be talking about the controversy surrounding this film and its depiction of the act of torture and torture's efficacy in finding Osama bin Laden. And after that, and after the review, we will be giving you our selections for your best bets coming out on Blu-ray and DVD for the week ahead, followed by a random selection, and then we will be signing off. If you aren't subscribing to us on iTunes already, shame on you. Why don't you go and do that for me? Also, drop us a comment, leave us a rating, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Now that we're done with all that, we can actually begin the show proper and get into our discussion of the controversy surrounding Zero Dark Thirty and its depiction of torture. This especially has become a little more heated now that the Academy Awards have come out, because a number of people have pointed out that Zero Dark Thirty was nominated for Best Picture of the Year, and yet Catherine Bigelow was not nominated for Best Director, and some people are attributing this to the massive controversy surrounding this film and the way that it uses torture and the way that it kind of states that torture may have had a hand in helping to catch Osama bin Laden, which is a thesis that a number of people who I'm sure have access to highly classified documents and CIA files say is completely bullshit. They say that there is absolutely no link between that. And you know what? I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that it happened, and it seems almost impossible to believe that at some point someone didn't say one name that could have gone somewhere, but who am I? So let's just take a look at the film itself and see whether or not we believe that this film actually endorses torture and its efficacy. So, Nick Newman, why don't we start off with you?
Well, no, the film does not advocate it, and I think that the fact that there is a controversy to begin with says quite a bit about the modern political discussion, because this is a film that's angering both conservatives and liberals. Some conservatives feel it doesn't go far enough, some liberals feel it doesn't. It goes too far, and both sides are wrong and stupid in this instance. I was watching MSNBC, which is, if you don't know, is the most liberal news network that you could have, basically. And they were discussing saying that they were angry over the film because they felt that it gave the Bush administration too much credit. And then I was reading an article on a conservative website because I hate myself. And the article said that, oh, the film is too critical of the Bush and Cheney administration because it doesn't give them enough credit. And that, to me, is a sign of how good the film is in walking a thin line. Because the movie is not about attributing those sorts of things to different groups of people. This is a movie that depicts things as they were, and depicting things as they were showed that torture was not a good system. And I remember how this controversy started, because there's this there's this moron named Glenn Greenwald, who writes for The Guardian, who wrote an article about the film before he had seen the film, which is kind of essential.
I don't know, man. I went to journalism school, and that seems like a perfectly sound journalistic tactic.
All right. Well, I didn't go to journalism school, so I stand corrected. Sorry, Glenn.
I am, of course, lying.
Anyway, he wrote this article about the film without having actually seen it, and he said that it advocated torture based on things that people had told him, things that were not, in fact, true, but okay. And this started stirring up a little controversy about what the movie was really up to, and it was infuriating for me because I had seen the film before this article had even come out. And when I saw the film, it never once occurred to me that this was advocating torture. It showed it to be an ugly, broken system that prevented these terrorist actions from breaking out. And yet, here we were dealing with this. And the fallout from has been very interesting. And I reject the idea that Kathryn Bigelow was not nominated because of the torture thing. Because if she was, why would they nominate the screenplay that supposedly advocates the acts itself? That's the only question I could really lob right now.
Not only that, but like I said, the film was still nominated for Best Picture as well.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. It's silly, and there have been very good pieces that refute the advocating torture argument, and I feel like when I'm reading them, I just feel as though when I read those articles, I just feel as though it's a shame that people are not understanding more correctly, and they're just going with a very reactionary stance.
And Danny, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think I fall pretty much in line with Nick. The point Nick brought up about the article being written before that writer had seen the film sort of casts an unfortunate shadow over it, because it's forced people to engage with that argument in a way that sort of precedes analyzing of the movie. So even people that like the film, they kind of come out of it feeling the need to respond to whether or not it endorses torture or not. And I think it's kind of a weird, misleading thing, especially because the depiction of torture is sort of in the first act of the movie, and then it kind of goes away. And this is nearly a 3-hour movie, so there's a lot of chunks in the film that have nothing to do with torture. A comparison I just thought of right now is, it's like people coming up to me and telling me that their favorite scene of Flight is the plane crash sequence, when the 2 hours of alcoholism is just, you know, meh, that was okay. It's just sort of like glossing over what the film's main focus is. I think Scott Feinberg on Twitter yesterday or a couple of days ago made an interesting comparison with Gus Van Sant's Elephant, which is another film that tried to take a really objective look at school shootings. And the argument, you know, the comment there was just kind of like, if Kathryn Bigelow is endorsing torture in Zero Dark Thirty, is Gus Van Sant endorsing school killings in Elephant? And the answer is obviously no. These are just two people that are depicting things in a objective manner that I think kind of throws people off, because they're used to like films that take sides and are maybe more easy to digest. But then again, he hadn't even seen the film when he wrote the article, so they goes back to that problem. But overall, I just think it's kind of a shame that a lot of the movie's discussion is boiled down to that argument, which is only a very kind of small portion of a very epic film.
Yeah, I would have to agree with the both of you. I, unlike you, had not seen the film by the time this controversy kicked into gear. And I mean, it's unfortunate that it did, because then, of course, it tries to color my viewing of the film, and so I'm keeping a lookout for it. So you'd think that if anyone was primed to see this idea that torture was being advocated in this film, it would be me. Because I'd already been told that it was. And, you know, the human brain likes to find things, you know, confirmation bias, things like that. And yet, as I was sitting there, and as I was watching this happen, all I could think of was, this shit isn't working. Like, it's obviously not working. And that was me getting lost in the film. And then when I was thinking about it later, this film takes place over, let's say, like 9 to 10 years. Good 7 of those years are wasted on the attempt to use torture to get anything done. It's ridiculous. The fact that people think that this portrays torture as a system that works is like people who look at Brazil and say that it's a huge polemic about how awesome bureaucracy is. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. And I feel like, I don't know if it's cultural sensitivity, that just seeing what we did and showing that at some point down the line, you know, some small piece of gold that got thrown out of the massive shitstorm that was the whole torture thing actually ended up doing something, just makes people really nervous. Like, I can't figure it out. It's really difficult for me to wrap my mind around, because there's a point where the torture in the movie stops, and that's the only point where things really start to happen. And for people to look at the morass of, like, just grimy, awful, I guess, vague violence, because a lot of it's more psychological than actual physical violence of the first 45 minutes, and say that that is the most effective part of the process shown, I mean, it's appalling to me. That just shows me someone who, I guess, is looking for a reason to be outraged, which I feel like is a default setting of a lot of people in our world. And I don't know why that is. But the other thing is, I mean, this movie does, like Danny said, takes an objective approach. It takes a journalistic approach. We tortured people. Unfortunately, get over it. It's something that happened. It's the same thing about people who talk about depicting slavery or the Holocaust. It happened. Are you not supposed to talk about it? Are you not supposed to show what happened? It just doesn't make sense to me. And so you figure that if this is happening and you're making a movie about this event, the capturing and the killing of Osama bin Laden, you need to show every part of that process. So I'm wondering in my head the kind of movie that these people who claim that this movie is pro-torture would have preferred to see. Would it have just picked up 7 years down the line and talked about all the tradecraft while completely glossing over the fact that there was torture? Because then you're censoring not only history, but our own dark part in, like, this entire crazy war on terror thing that's been happening. And you're basically giving us a pass, because you're not bothering to show the awful depths that we went to in what we thought was the name of a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are people who would not be satisfied unless it conforms entirely to their own political opinions.
Which is ridiculous. Again, it's odd to be bringing this up. It's the same thing I had with Life of Pi. Something doesn't have to conform to my political opinions, as long as it's not being overtly, angrily against them, or it's not just trying to make things stupid to vindicate its own point of view. I appreciate a film that can actually look at ideas and facts in a timeline and place it together. And in placing those facts and timelines together, can create a narrative that, while it may not be the thing that I want to see, is closely approximating or in the spirit of the thing that actually happened. We tortured people. Get over it. It happened. It's a terrible thing. I don't condone it. And while I don't believe that it was nearly as effective as any other method could have been, and they do show other methods in this movie, for instance, bribery, we have to come to terms with that, and we have to look at ourselves and realize that's something we did, and we also have to realize that we don't know everything. We're movie critics, primarily. I don't know what happened in those dark rooms and cells, often undisclosed locations of black sites. Is it completely inconceivable that at some point someone said a name? A name that the movie even shows had already been said about a year earlier, and had shown up on a list a year before that. This movie doesn't say that torture works. If anything, it says that torture completely muddles and destroys whatever chain of evidence you could collect, and that by focusing on it so much, you've basically lost the entirety of whatever moral standing you have, in addition to getting bad intelligence. It only appears to me that the most simplistic and biased reading of this movie can make you believe that torture was vindicated in it. But that's just me.
Yeah, I think you make a good point that the movie does show torture being as ineffective as effective. You know, there's like a good balance she strikes there. And I also think it's interesting, too, because to me, kind of like the most disturbing part of the first kind of 20 or 30 minutes of this movie is like Jason Clarke's performance and just the way he interprets that character. And it's so weird to me that kind of pro-torture complainers regarding this movie are getting worked up over the fact that a name was revealed through torture techniques. That's what's kind of freaking them out, and not the fact that this guy is sort of treating these people completely mercilessly and just being a total jerk and inhuman. And I think it's just weird that like these minute details are what's kind of driving these people up the walls.
Yeah, absolutely. The weird thing, though, is, and this is something we can get into further in the film, you say that he's treating them, like, mercilessly and without humanity. It's odd to see the way that he acts in front of them and then the way that he talks about it later on.
Yeah, he just turns on a dime.
Yeah.
It's really so interesting.
And it's so weird. And then again, it does such a good job of showing that this wasn't like something that we were doing for kicks. It was genuinely believed to be something that worked. And throughout the course of the movie, it's proven that it doesn't. I don't get it. I don't understand. It's one of these things where it kind of blows my mind a little bit, insofar as to say that I'm trying to get into the mindset of someone who saw it that way, and all I can think is that they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that to place myself in a position of authority over them. I'm just saying that as a means of dictating my own bafflement over the idea. It doesn't make sense to me that someone could look at this and fall in line with that idea.
Yeah, I think also a big factor is these articles are coming from people who are not film critics. You say how because we're film critics and we don't have the same depth of knowledge regarding the subject as some other people. Well, it goes the other way around in this instance.
Well, I'm just saying
there are two pieces that I think anybody interested in this debate should be required to read. One is by Ignaty Vishnevetsky. It's on Mubi, where it's more a review of the film, but he does talk in depth about the idea of patriotic depictions in the film. And the other is by Glenn Kenny on his blog, Some Came Running, where he completely dismantles this argument that the film advocates torture. And after reading it, I think if that article was just widely read, there would be no further discussion about it. Because he explains in depth how the language of the film clearly shows that torture was a bad thing. But someone like Glenn Greenwald is not going to grasp that, unfortunately. So
that is quite unfortunate. Well, at this point, I feel like, again, this is one of those debates that we're obviously not going to be able to solve. But it's good to air our opinions on it, because we are here to talk about the film itself and not just the controversy. And so this will kind of free up our review to focus more on what is depicted in the film rather than what some people believe is depicted in the film. So I think unless anyone else has anything to throw in, we should probably get into our review. Correct, gentlemen?
Let's do it.
All right. So our main review of Zero Dark Thirty, again, directed by Catherine Bigelow and written by Mark Boll, starring Jessica Chastain, Jason Clarke, Kyle Chandler, Harold Pirineau, along with appearances from Chris Pratt, Joel Egerton, and Mark Duplass.
Can I be honest with you? I am bad news. I'm not your friend. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to break you. Any questions?
Maya, this is Joseph Bradley, our station chief.
Nice to meet you.
You too, sir.
You don't think she's a little young for the hard stuff?
Washington says she's a killer.
So Zero Dark Thirty, for anyone who doesn't know, which seems almost impossible to me, but nonetheless, this is a movie about the hunt for Osama bin Laden in the years following the 9/11 terror attacks. Follows a number of people, but primarily through the lens of CIA analyst Maya, who is played by Jessica Chastain. And it shows her obsessive, single-minded pursuit of Osama bin Laden, and the way in which the meaning behind capturing or killing him changes throughout all of these years, which I think is one of the more important parts of this film that I haven't heard a lot of people talking about. But then again, before I see a film, I try to avoid all reviews and discussion. So maybe I'm wrong. But gentlemen, let us get into this. Let us talk about Zero Dark Thirty. Danny King, why don't you start us off? What were your thoughts on this film?
Well, as evidenced by last week's show when I put Zero Dark Thirty in my top 10, I think this is a really great film. I think, you know, you mentioned one aspect of the movie that you think has been under-discussed. I think perhaps another one is how intriguing of a companion piece this film is to Catherine Bigelow and Mark Boll's previous The Hurt Locker. While Zero Dark Thirty does have the very drawn out and intricately staged sequence showing the killing of bin Laden at the end, it's mostly a film about kind of office place discussions and really minute details in a way that the battle scene of The Hurt Locker was completely different. But at the same time, in a thematic sense, they're both sort of about the obsession that kind of war and battle and strategy can ignite in these two central personalities, Jeremy Renner's in The Hurt Locker and Jessica Chastain's in Zero Dark Thirty. The more I think about it, the more I think Zero Dark Thirty really works in a way that's similar to Lincoln, which is that both films manage to kind of balance a character study and sort of a very grueling, drawn out procedural, and they manage to balance them very well. I think that Zero Dark Thirty is really well acted throughout too. Jason Clarke in particular, who I mentioned earlier, I think gives a really outstanding performance. And the fact that he sort of conforms into an office drone as the film goes on and on makes the role even more complicated. And I just think that the film is paced extremely well for a 2-hour and 40-minute movie. It's kind of like a breathless experience. And yeah, just big fan.
And Nick, what about yourself?
Like my esteemed co-host, I'm also a big fan. This is a movie that I saw over a month ago, and I've just been turning it over in my mind since. I feel like I've had adequate time to really think about it, even after writing a review. My opinion has changed a little bit since then, just because it's a film that I think... it's a film that demands critical thought. This is not something that you can go in and just enjoy as a piece of entertainment, even though you could have that experience. It is asking more of you than that. And because of that, I think the film is a great accomplishment in terms of the fact that it's able to actually pull off what it is achieving, and that it does feel like a historical document that is very much, you see that quote in the TV spot, a movie of the moment. And I hate talk like that, but I do think it is true ultimately. And the fact that it's also just a very good film on top of that is all the more surprising. And it almost feels wrong that this movie that's generated so much discussion is actually really good too. That normally does not happen, but nevertheless. And yeah, I also am mostly a fan, I think, of the... I'm more a fan of the Catherine Bigelow's work than Mark Bowles. I'm not sure how good of a screenwriter Mark Bull actually is, to be honest, after this and The Hurt Locker. I think that if it wasn't for Catherine Bigelow, he would not be in the place that he is, basically. Because I do think that it is ultimately Bigelow's work and the work of the cast that elevates this above the standard, just like another episode of 24 or Homeland or something. Not to get back into the torture discussion with 24, of course, but nevertheless. So... this is a much better film than The Hurt Locker too, which I think should be stressed. I was not a fan of The Hurt Locker at all, and that left me a little skeptical about this going in. I was thinking, well, okay, is this going to be another Hurt Locker? Because if that's the case, no dice. But this is a very different film. It's a much smarter film. It's a much more incisive film. And let's get the discussion brewing, I say.
I'm curious as to why you did not like The Hurt Locker.
I think that it is an empty character piece wrapped in generic set pieces.
Huh, interesting. I think I like The Hurt Locker a little more than this film.
I know.
What would an episode be if we didn't kind of disagree on something? That is not to say that I didn't like this film. I do agree that The Hurt Locker had some generic set pieces, and I... further, I'm excited to agree that...
Except they weren't well directed. It's not that. It's just that, again, I think it comes down mostly to Mark Bowl.
Yeah, honestly. No, that's precisely what I was going to say. When I was coming home from this film last night, I was talking with some friends in the car, and I said that Jessica Chastain brought oceans of depth to a character that was written paper thin. And I feel like that's true for everyone in this film. Like, if they didn't have the clout... and the talent to get a cast of characters like this, and to take some really odd choices. I'm still mind-boggled that Mark Duplass is in this. I mean, it would just be, like you said, standard boilerplate, you know, to tradecraft, to follow the car, like that type of thing. Like, it really takes these actors to instill something else into their characters. It's actually the same issue that I have with Aaron Sorkin. He writes really great florid dialogue, and he has characters who are great at sounding intelligent, but if you just read it on a page and you took out character names, you would have no idea who was ever speaking. you need the actors to come in. So there are certain screenwriters who I feel attract good actors because the actors know that they have almost complete and utter control over how their characters are going to be. And so, yeah, very excited that you talked about Mark Bull and his screenplay. Otherwise, yeah, I found this to be an engrossing film. I found the direction to be wonderful. For some reason, I really like the cinematography in some places as well.
The cinematographer is his name's like Grieg Fraser. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his first name right, but he also worked on Killing Them Softly, which was also really well shot.
This film
looks completely differently, but equally accomplished.
Killing Them Softly, I one of the things that I would not have a problem with that in that film is the shooting. So yeah, excellent. I can't remember what I was going to say now. Oh, this film's engrossing. Jason Clarke playing Dan is fantastic. I'm surprised that I've heard so much talk about Jessica Chastain, and yet Jason Clarke apparently has been given nothing that I've heard of, which is ridiculous. He's great. Not to say that Jessica Chastain is not also great, but I feel like it's kind of a two-man show for the first 45 minutes of the film, and he more than ably holds up his part of the bargain. And when he's brought in later, you can see the change that his character has undergone, and it's, you know, it's not dramatic, but you can see it. It's there, and you get a feel for him as a person, and you get a feel for the relationship that he has gotten to a point of with Maya, that he trusts her implicitly because he's watched her. I mean, but these aren't things that are in the script, I feel. Like, in the script, if it was done on, like, a stage with people just doing a live reading, it would seem almost completely nonsensical. So, excellent direction and acting to overcome a script that is a little weak.
I do disagree about Jessica Chastain's character, though. I think that she's a much more interesting one than Jeremy Renner's in The Hurt Locker. Because because she is using this work to sort of consume herself. And I think that is her character. Yes. Whereas in The Hurt Locker, for instance, not to play too much of a comparison game, I felt that the film undercut itself by resorting to thrills when it's about someone who is in a very unfortunate moral predicament.
But here I think it's
much more, not just significant, but much more cogent, too.
But in The Hurt Locker, the entire point is that he's become addicted to the rush of war. So if you don't feel that rush at the same time, then I think that the movie would be less effective.
That's true, but I don't think the movie did a good job of communicating the unfortunate side of that. Whereas I think that this does a much, much better job of communicating how unfortunate it is that she's been subsumed into the whereabouts of this one man.
I guess, but you don't get any sense of who she is outside of this. So I disagree, though.
I don't think that's true. How much do you actually want to know about who she is outside of this? I mean, really? Do you really want to know her home life?
I don't need to know her home life.
You know, what she's doing with her friends. I mean, you get enough of that. I think that the scenes with Jennifer L. are a good example of that. I think that that provides the proper context that you need for this character's emotional side. Or rather, I should say, a more traditional emotional side. I think that the dedication to this job is her core.
I guess. I don't know, man. I just, like, there's a point where she's talking about how long she's been doing this and working the Osama bin Laden lead. And she says she was recruited out of high school, right? And
yeah.
Because earlier they talked about one of the guys having a PhD, Dan, Jason Clarke's character. And I was like, that's cool, because a lot of the times when you think about these people, especially the people who are torturing, you have been kind of conditioned to envision some brute who doesn't know what the hell he's doing, just beating a guy, asking for names. And here you have a man who obviously has a keen analytical mind, who has a PhD in something, which is not something that you can easily get.
He's got a PhD in biology, bro.
It's biology, bro. Oh, man. And now I've lost my entire train of thought, thinking about him and all the times he said dude and bro to a guy who he was waterboarding. They at some point even say, when she's like, I was recruited out of high school, one of the guys says, well, you know why we did that. But like, I don't know, and I'm kind of furious that I don't know. And it doesn't really affect my enjoyment of the film, but it's just one of these things where it's like...
But you're furious!
Cloaked in immense anger. No, I just want to know. Like, it's just weird because she says she's been in there for 10 years or 12 years. It is at this point 2011, which means that she was recruited in 1999, which means that at the time like that they bring her in, it's been something like 3 to 4 years since she's been recruited. I just don't know. There's a timeline happening for her as a person, and it's kind of blowing my mind. And I don't know why we're spending this much time talking about it, but I mean, I don't need a scene where she goes home and talks to her father who has Alzheimer's disease, and we find out that her little brother was killed in 9/11. Like, I don't need that. But any kind of portrait of the person that she could have been or is keeping on the side on a back burner, waiting to get back to once this job is over, would have helped a little bit. Whereas Jeremy Renner's character in the other film, you do get the idea that he does have all this other stuff, but he doesn't want it. He wants to be back in the world where everyone could die in a single moment's notice.
Mm.
But again, I think I now sound so much more critical of this film than I ever wanted to be. Thank you, Nick. I think
you fell into my trap.
Damn it. I think that Jessica Chastain is brilliant. I think that Jason Clarke is wonderful. All the actors in general are very good. And the final scene that the Navy SEALs action that takes place inside of this compound in Abbottabad is led up to very well. You get a great idea of all the different tradecraft that goes on in order to try to find and capture this person. The movie has some really thrilling moments of just people in a car sitting around looking for a signal. Though there are some holes every now and then, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around some things, and I don't know if that's because of the pace or complexity or density of the film. But no, it's really good. And the final set piece is an excellent exercise in, like, action movie with reality thrown in. Like, there's a point where it's almost like a comedy of errors, this entire SEAL mission that happens. Like, things just keep going wrong, and they have to continuously find workarounds for them. And it's almost like a miracle that it worked at all. It says a lot about these people's ability to adapt. Because, are we doing spoilers for this? Is it a spoilery type
I don't
thing?
Know how much you can spoil, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
no,
okay.
No spoilers. I'm sorry, if you care about spoilers, just stop listening.
Yeah, I was about to say, we're not going to do spoilers. I'm about to say some, but okay, I have a humorous anecdote that we can talk about after I'm done giving my statement, which will tie into a final point I'd like to make. But yeah, the second that helicopter went down, if I had been there, I'd have been like, oh shit, guys, it's over. Let's just get the hell out of here. Let's run. And they're just like, the helicopter fell. Jump out. And then they're like, I missed the part of the plan where that was supposed to happen. It's just like, these guys are incredible. And just watching the amount of time that passes between finding that house. Basically what I'm trying to say while going through every plot point in the movie is that I really enjoyed this film. I was just about to get wrapped up in basically doing like a little kid who just saw Jurassic Park going like, and then the helicopter lands, and then they see a brontosaurus, and then they see the raptors, and then they go in the car, and then they do this. So I'm just going to say, yeah, it's a great film.
Yeah, I just want to talk about Mark Boll for a second. Because I agree that he, I don't know if he's a fully polished screenwriter. I think this screenplay is maybe more uneven than the Hurt Lockers, maybe just by nature, because it's trying to tackle so much within one story. But I think you have to give him credit for what he's allowed Kathryn Bigelow to do. I haven't seen a lot of her earlier films, but from what I can tell, these are certainly... Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty are certainly her two most acclaimed works, and they brought her a level of recognition that a lot of people think that she's deserved for a long time. And so, I mean, I would agree that both of these films are more feats of direction than they are writing, but there's definitely something that he is igniting in her that's kind of brought her work to a new level, and I think that's something that should be like given a lot of credit. And I also think that something Brian mentioned that's interesting about the pacing of Zero Dark Thirty is that even though it is kind of a procedural, it has a much more kind of breakneck speed than The Hurt Locker, even though Hurt Locker is technically like an action movie. a lot of those set pieces there were really drawn out and kind of methodical, where you really kind of felt the length and like the heat of those days. But Zero Dark 30 just goes boom, boom, boom. There's never really any time to breathe. And I think it's interesting that the two of them brought that kind of pacing to a procedural. You know, even thinking, like, as entertaining as it is, it has a much different pace. And I think that's interesting.
Mm. Was that your retort, Nick?
No.
You just said, hmm.
Yeah, it is a different pace. I think I preferred overall, I prefer Lincoln. That's a different discussion. But I do think that the film's pacing becomes a bit of an issue during the second act, where there is, I feel a little uncomfortable criticizing it for this aspect, because if they are showing a fidelity to the historical record, then I would prefer this, but still. I do think that in the second act, the film starts to get weighed down a bit when it's about the search for, I'm not going to remember his name, Abu Akbed. Ryan, you just saw the movie, and they say his name 100 times. So
yeah, it's Abu Akbed.
You're the one who remembers the most. It was at that point where I thought that maybe the film could have afforded to kind of cut through it a bit, just because there is a moment, there's a stretch of maybe 20 or 30 minutes where they're not really getting anywhere. And I understand why you would have it there, because it is part of the frustration, and it makes the build up to the actual capture, but it makes the build up to the raid itself more thrilling and satisfying, I suppose. I feel a little uncomfortable using that word, but I just did, so who cares? I do think that, however, that the portions in the second act where they're searching for this one man do become a little tiring, and I would have preferred if they could, in fact, just found a way around it, sort of.
I understand that complaint. There was a point where it's weird when you're watching a movie like this and you're like, man, like nothing is happening. And then you have a thought in the back of your head where it's like, I'm watching a 2.5 hour movie and I'm thinking nothing is happening. What must these people have thought during their 9-year manhunt? And so I think that was an effective, if controversial, idea of what to do. Like, let's just have like a 20-minute stretch in this movie where things kind of grind to a halt. Because there was a point where they flashed up a title screen, a Chiron, and it said, like, you know, 2009. I was like, wait a second, wasn't it just 2003? So I think if I could critique the movie for anything, it might be losing me that sense of time. But at the same time, I could just be the fact that, again, the movie's paced kind of breakneck, and if they throw enough information at you, something's bound to slip through, so I'm not sure if maybe I missed the interim. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, I don't know if I'm just forgetting all the other times that it was 2009 or 2006, or because the movie spans a long, long period of time, and getting people to understand the stretch of time is a difficult thing to do in a film, and I'm not sure this was entirely effective. But towards the end, when Maya is writing the amount of time that has passed between finding the compound and actually making a move on it, which I thought was insanely effective, and again, another great character moment.
One of the interesting things about the climax, and I think this is maybe somewhere, like one aspect where a more polished screenwriter could have capitalized on it even more. One of the most interesting thematic ideas for me in the movie is the fact that Maya is doing a lot of her work just in her office, like looking at videos and looking at old files. But when it comes down to Judgment Day, she's kind of sitting in a room and she has to watch other people do the work that she's been setting up for so long. And I think that disconnect between like the prep work she's done and the actual act is kind of a really interesting relationship that I think sort of maybe disappears a bit in the climax, where I feel like Catherine Bigelow is just really wanting to get into her action mode and just make like an awesome set piece. Whereas I think maybe some more moments like the final shot of the film could have perhaps been incorporated into the actual raid.
And what do we feel about that final shot of the film?
I love it.
Nick?
Yeah, it's none too subtle, where the guy asks, where do you want to go? And it feels as though, okay, Mark Bull, thanks. Bravo, sir. Yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate that that line is the last of the film, because it's a little dopey. But the shot itself, I think that's a perfect encapsulation of the film in a way, where you have the screenplay doing something kind of lunkheaded, and then you have Catherine Bigelow and Jessica Chastain alleviating it and making it to something special.
Yeah.
Because the last shot of the movie, I think, is very troubling, because it's basically saying that sometimes you just can't go back. And I think that is a comment that it's making about the United States in general at the end of the movie. I think that it's saying, well, no, this is where we are now. And even if you've accomplished your task, there's still a scar that's left on you. And I was very surprised by that, unless I was reading the shot wrong and that was in fact the case.
I don't believe you were, because there's the shots that precede it, the scene that precedes it, is this entire movie, her entire purpose has been spent wading through tapes and DVDs and computer files looking for Osama bin Laden. And then they find him, and then they kill him, and then they bring him back. And there's a great scene where she's in a tent watching as everyone is cataloging all of the intelligence that they received from this raid. And off in the corner is the body bag that holds Osama bin Laden. The man who was so important has now been subsumed by all of the information they got. And you can just kind of see in her face, like, she's looking at all of those tapes and hard drives, and she's just like, there's more of it now. It's happening still. Like, this hasn't really stopped anything. If anything, it's only made it worse. Though, apparently all that information was then completely useless because of the announcement that was made regarding the killing. So that's almost an even worse idea to take, is that he's dead, and you got this treasure trove of information, and now it's completely bricked and pointless. But yeah, the final shot of her, I totally agree with you on that. Where you want to go, or whatever the hell that guy said. Though it is pretty awesome that the government apparently just sent, like, a C-140 for her, and was just like, taxi her around, like, take her somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? At that point, I would have wanted to say, like, the most random place I could think of, and just see if the guy would be like, okay. But her acting in that final scene was great. It's the cathartic emotional release. And it was only vaguely scarred for me by the man in front of me continuously checking and texting on his phone, and the couple next to me speaking loudly while some sort of alarm went off on their phone.
Was this during the final shot?
This was during the final shot.
Cocksucker.
Okay. Unfortunately, it had been happening throughout the entire movie. Guys, this is a personal aside, but I had the worst theater experience of my life watching this film, and the fact that I was still able to concentrate so fully on it and be so engrossed by it is a testament to the film.
Mm-hmm.
A testament. The people next to me were probably on drugs, because at first they were talking loudly and deeply and meanderingly. Then they fell asleep and started snoring. The guy in front of me was constantly on his phone. The guy two rows down was constantly on his phone. The woman on the other side of me was constantly getting up to go use her phone. Ladies and gentlemen who are listening to this, please, for the love of God, can we just...
Put away your fucking phone!
Yeah, what the hell is happening to us as a culture? At some point towards the end, I was, like, in full-on death wish mode. Like, you know how usually when something like that happens, you try to do a polite shh? Or you try to ignore it. It was so pervasive that I finally started actually calling people out and shaming them. And the guy in front of me, I kicked his chair as hard as I could. And yet, in spite of all that, I remember this movie clearly, briskly, and I loved it, and I can't wait to see it again. Hopefully in the comfort of my own home, because this experience may have ruined movies for me forever.
No.
Oh, and what we were talking about, spoilers, and I said I had a humorous anecdote. When the Navy SEALs were going through the compound and shooting people and looking for Osama bin Laden, the drugged out couple next to me very loudly said, "Hey, I thought they found him in a hole." And the girl was like, "Yeah, I thought they found him in a hole in the desert too." And for a moment, only a moment, was my anger at them drifted away, because I wanted to turn and correct them and be like, "You're thinking of Saddam Hussein." Oh, and then man. I remembered, oh wait, I shouldn't have to answer their fucking stupid question, because we're in a movie theater.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Sorry, I need someone to yell at about this, and I feel like you two would understand this. Like, it's amazing, because if this movie was even a little bit worse, the actions of the people in this theater could have ruined it for me, to the point where I would have had to actually postpone this recording to see it again.
Mm. I saw this at a press screening, and somebody pulled out their phone during the raid sequence.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding.
What is wrong with the
and at a, the at worst a part professional is, quote unquote screening? Yeah, someone did this.
The worst part is that when I turned to this couple and I said shh, you know, I shushed them very loudly, and the girl turned and looked at me and gave me this look like mind your own business, and I shot her back my most threatening, "Are you fucking kidding me?" And that shut her up, and then the guy in front of me pulled out his phone for the 20th time, and I kicked the back of his chair as hard as I could, and he looked back at me, expecting an apology. What is happening to our world, people?
This is what they should have made a film about. The hunt for...
shitty moviegoers?
I don't know. Just, let's keep talking.
Actually started, like, really kind of liking the idea of texting during movies. I don't know about you. But it helps me, like, sort of connect with the films. I don't know.
I like to live tweet the movies that I'm seeing.
Yeah, no, I've done that too.
Yeah,
no,
and then
when I saw Zero Dark Thirty, I was tweeting it live, spoilers and everything.
Yeah. Again, there aren't really spoilers in this film, but apparently if you're that couple, there would have been a spoiler. So yeah, that's my, like, rant that kind of folds in, because honestly, like, this movie was good enough for me to... Like, if that had been happening during Dark Shadows, forgive me, I would have walked out. But this movie was so good that I was like, no, I'm going to continue watching, because I'm invested, and it's a very, very great film. And luckily, for, like, the middle hour and a half, I was completely able to tune out all these maniacs. The one thing I did want to talk about, the final point that I'll make, this is a movie that's very good, and it has a bunch of great actors, and Mark Strong is in it, and he gives a very interesting performance, because at first... he comes in and does the blustering Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross kind of speech. And then later on, you see him as kind of like this desk hack. And that's like a lot of this film, is people just behind a desk. Like, it's a job. And we talked about Jason Clarke and his turning on a dime with respect to how he's acting in the outside world and then towards the prisoners. And it's a job. It's a very necessary ruse that they put on that they almost don't believe themselves. And it's weird how the kind of shouting, threatening is used not only against the prisoners, but against their own people when they're not getting results that they want. And I loved that. And so I was excited when Mark Strong was presenting his case to the National Security Advisor, who's played by Stephen Delaney, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He played Stannis Baratheon on Game of Thrones. The only problem that I had was that, and again, this may just be me, Mark Strong is a actor from the UK who has a fairly convincing American accent in this. Stephen Delaney didn't seem to be trying at all. Am I the only person who felt that way?
Yeah, he definitely had an accent.
Yeah. For a good long while, I was wondering about why we had a British national security advisor. And then I thought that maybe he was with another country. Like, maybe the British were involved in some way. And it's just weird to me that in a movie that strives so much towards some level of veracity... that something like that would happen. And I don't know what that says, but it's something that I felt the need to bring up because it was, like, really distracting for that one scene. But apparently I'm the only person who noticed.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really have a reaction to that at all. I don't know what... I would say, though, that a lot of the kind of truth to that workplace element probably comes from Mark Bull's journalism experience. And he probably has the level of understanding of that might not have been able to be achieved with a more traditional kind of storyline. I think there is something really interesting about, you know, what you mentioned, how these people, this is their job and they approach it like that, but they can also sort of turn up the flames when they need to.
Yeah. And part of me wonders that if it was a more interesting screenwriter, if you would have lost some of that veracity, because their impulse would have been to push it towards something more dramatic.
Yeah, I definitely think that would have been something that could have been lost.
So maybe a boring screenwriter is exactly what we need for a story like this.
Mm.
Yeah.
I don't know. I loved everything with Mark Strong in this movie.
I'm fine with Mark Strong. It's Stephen Delaney I had an issue with.
I know, but the accent thing did not concern me in the slightest.
It concerned me only insofar as, like, in most films, I wouldn't have a problem with it, but because this is a film that it deals with an event in reality, I assume that most of the choices made are made to further my understanding of said reality. But at the very least, you shouldn't have a British man as the National Security Advisor. Unless he is. I mean, I'll have to look that up, but I don't feel like... I don't know. It's just like the one thing in this movie that felt really off place was Stephen Delaney. I was just like, wait, what the hell is... Why? But again, maybe it's just because I was in a shitty theater and I was primed to try to find something that I didn't like, and this movie gave me literally nothing else to hold on to. Shout out to the monkeys that steal Jason McClark's ice cream cone.
Yeah, that was great.
Any final thoughts on this, guys, before we push off into our next section?
I find it funny that Oliver Stone doesn't like this movie.
I just want to say that.
Especially because Oliver Stone has devolved into a hack. That's one thing that he has the balls to criticize this film when it's like, you know, fuck you, Oliver Stone. But
there wasn't enough conspiracy. I find that. No one said back into the left. I did not hear about that, but it does.
Did he say like why or anything?
He said he thinks that it's politically bothersome. Oliver Stone finds
that movie politically bothersome.
He would be offended by that.
Yeah. I was okay.
But I think that's a sign of how good this film really is, and that it's angering people on both sides because it's not conforming to their ideals.
Exactly. Exactly. I have to agree with you 100% there. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, now you know we think you should all go out and see Zero Dark Thirty, and it's fantastic. I did have a friend who I wanted to bring to this movie, or I won't say I wanted to. I invited to bring to this movie, and they said that they refused to see it on principle because they didn't feel like this was something we should be celebrating. And if anyone else has that kind of feeling, it's not a celebration, guys. You're wrong. Again, just because a movie shows something doesn't mean it condones it. James Cameron is not celebrating the sinking of the Titanic. Oh, my God. Anyway.
Is that friend, like, seeing a haunted house right now, or what?
No, they're not. They're sitting at home watching Netflix reruns of The West Wing. Which is why I brought up Aaron Sorkin earlier, because I've never seen that show, and I tried watching it, and it's just like, holy shit, this is such an Aaron Sorkin show.
You got some problems with that guy.
Yeah. His last like 20 years of work has been bullshit. Anyway, moving on. Blu-ray and DVD releases. We have Taken 2, starring Liam Neeson. On Criterion, we have The Tin Drum and The Man Who Knew Too Little. We also have Hannah and Her Sisters and Sleeper.
The Man Who Knew Too Little is a Bill Murray movie.
Did I say too little? Because I meant to say too much.
The Man Who Knew Too Much. The original The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yes, The Man Who Knew Too Much. Jesus. We also have How Green Was My Valley, which is an Academy Award-winning film. I don't know why I know that. Wake in Fright, which is something we talked about that I enjoyed greatly. And To Roam with Love, The Intouchables, and The Paperboy, amongst a few other films that, if anyone is interested in, can bring up. I personally am going to recommend Wake in Fright, because, as you all know, I enjoyed it when we watched it, and then I saw it in a 35mm print at my local theater, and I liked it even more. So that's my choice.
Yeah, good movie.
feel free to nominate something of your own or back me up.
Oh, well, back up Wake and Fright, and then I would also propose a Woody Allen double feature of Sleeper and Hannah and Her Sisters. I think I talked about Sleeper a little bit when we discussed time travel movies for Looper. And Sleeper is just absolutely hilarious. One of the funniest movies I've seen from him. And then Hannah and Her Sisters, which a lot of people think is one of his very best films, is also really good.
But I notice how you're not recommending To Roam with Love, which also comes out.
To Roam with Love is also not as good as the other two ones there. Yeah, that movie's a little weak for me.
Okay.
Nick, what about
yourself? I don't have much to recommend. I've never seen the original Man Who Knew Too Much with Peter Lorre, so I would like to check that out. Also, How Green Was My Valley by John Ford. That is, unfortunately, today it's most famous as the film that beat Citizen Kane for Best Picture.
Having not seen
How Green Was My Valley, I still think that's unfair. But that's all the more reason to check it out, honestly. Because who knows, maybe it's better. But, you know, it's John Ford, so it essentially becomes an important film, so to speak.
Yes. I should also point out that a movie called Branded is coming out on Blu-ray. Somewhat universally agreed to be the worst or most baffling film of the year. So maybe you should check that out. Though, guys, I think I found it. I think I found the universally agreed upon most important film that you should watch this week that comes out on Blu-ray. 30 Nights of Paranormal Activity with the Devil Inside the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, God.
All right, let's move on.
That is brutal.
Oh, my God. The world is awful. All right, coming to theaters this week, January 19th, we have another Jessica Chastain film. It is.
I believe it's January 18th.
What did I say?
You said January 19th.
Guys, I think I had a stroke. Mm. I don't know what's wrong with me. Coming to theaters this Friday, January 18th, we have another Jessica Chastain film. This is Mama, which is, I'm not going to... Nick, do you want to take a crack at the director's name? Because I don't know what it is. You're our pronunciation guy.
I have to look up who the director of Mama is first.
Oh, it's Andres Muschietti?
Well, did you just do it? Andres Muschietti.
Okay, great. So we're in agreement. This is produced by Guillermo del Toro and starring Jessica Chastain. As I said, it's a horror movie that has a vaguely ridiculous trailer where a little girl says the word Mama over and over again. Then we also have The Last Stand, which is by Ji-Woon Kim, who some people may recognize as the director of I Saw the Devil. It stars Arnold Schwarzenegger as a sheriff who has to stop a guy from doing a thing that people don't want him to do. And then we have Broken City with Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe. Mark Wahlberg fulfilling his role as January's top star. And then we have Love, L-U-V. We have Outside Satan as well. So, guys, thoughts on this week's slate of movies?
Stay home.
Slim pickings.
Slim pickings. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say about this.
I did see Contraband last year for some reason, so I wonder if I'm just like contractually obligated to see Broken City.
I think you are.
I think there's like a silent agreement there that if you saw Contraband, you have to see Broken You'll City. See fucking if you don't, anything. There's something wrong.
No, don't see Broken City.
This is another one of those things where I might have to see it just because it's like ex-cop Private Eye doing a thing, but probably not because I'm not that invested in that. The Last Stand looks like it could be goofy fun. And, yeah.
I don't know. I am troubled by the fact that every piece of advertisement centers around a school bus, because that to me indicates that there's one big action scene in the film and the rest is dull build-up, as it becomes so common with most mainstream American action films.
This is true.
I am almost convinced that that is the case with this movie.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I think that that's a fair...
And I'm not joking, I'm being completely serious. Every trailer, TV spot, even the poster, it all centers around scenes set in or in the immediate vicinity of that school bus, which to me is the big flashing warning sign.
Either that or the school bus is just like the A-team's car and it's just always there.
Hey, maybe. I would be thrilled if Arnold Schwarzenegger's first solo outing in like a decade or so is in fact... you know, worthwhile return, but
I appreciate the fact that on some of the posters for this, they give it the kind of 70s grindhouse kind of poster. You know what I'm talking about? Like the rotoscoped type of, I don't know. It at least shows some kind of like self-awareness from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah, I'm tired of that.
Okay. Well, then let's quit talking about this. We really don't fully endorse anything that's coming out this weekend. So enter at your own risk.
We'll have to figure out what to review.
What was that?
We'll have to figure out what to review.
If we don't want to talk about one of those, we could talk about Amour and or Gangster Squad. That's what I'm going to say.
Not Gangster Squad.
Okay. Well, then maybe we'll talk about Amour.
Maybe.
Jesus.
Jeez.
God, Nick, why you got to be so down on things?
Get low.
Get low.
I will not be inserting that sound cue into this week's.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, I hope everyone enjoyed that. That's yeah. Anyway. All right. Random recommendations from the week. Danny, let's start off with you. What is something that you saw that you think we should check out?
I'm going to recommend another double feature. two Kelly Reichardt films that are currently on Netflix Instant, and they're called Old Joy and Meek's Cut Off, and they're the first and third films in her Oregon trilogy. The second one being Wendy and Lucy, starring Michelle Williams. And Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy are both based on short stories by a guy named Jonathan Raymond, and he also wrote the screenplay for Meek's Cut Off. So that's kind of an interesting collaboration there. Meek's Cut Off is definitely the better of the two movies. It's shot in the Academy ratio, which is that kind of boxy frame that was also used in Wuthering Heights last year from Andrea Arnold. And just on an atmospheric level, it's a pretty astonishing piece of craft. Everything from cinematography to sound to editing. Meek's Cut Off is just a pretty outstanding kind of atmospheric experience. Old Joy is a bit kind of smaller scale of a production, but I still really liked it. It's only about 70 minutes, and not much happens in Meek's Cut Off either, but she kind of has this knack for capturing a lot of kind of emotional weight in these small gestures. And as minor as Old Joy is, it kind of builds to a really effectively sad conclusion, I thought, and it's a pretty good movie.
Old Joy makes me feel very dirty.
Definitely.
It's a movie that's very much down in the dirt.
It's just like really sad.
Is that the movie where like the two friends
Good, but it's just like, it's kind of a downer.
The movie ends and then they have to go live in Portland, so it's very sad.
That the movie where the two friends go to the woods together?
Yeah, have you seen it? Or
I have not, but I want to.
Yeah.
So and that's on Netflix Instant, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like 70 minutes. It's worth checking out.
Meek's Cut Off is majestic.
I
remember the talk about that film a couple of years ago.
I'm pretty mad at myself now that I missed it in a theater.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All
right.
It's almost disgusting.
Nick, what about yourself?
Speaking of disgusting, I watched Sallow or the 120 Days of Sodom by Paolo Pasolini.
That's a good
date. Anybody here seen this film?
I have not seen it. I own it. Or I don't own it, but I bought it for my girlfriend, so I guess it's technically...
What kind of relationship are you in?
She liked Antichrist, so I viewed the film as something that she might enjoy. She's into challenging films, let me say that. She's not afraid of stuff like that, so I encourage that.
I mean, this is a challenging film, you could say that. Okay, first off... before I get into something else, I think this film is a masterpiece. That should just be said. I don't know how else I could start this because of where this is going to go. Because at the same time, this is a repellent film. It is extremely, extremely difficult to watch. And I say that as someone who usually has a stomach for these sorts of things. But holy moly, this movie. And I'm sorry that it's devolving into this, but it's not often that I feel compelled to look away from the screen as I'm watching a movie, but Pasolini is able to do it. If you see his work, he's really into private parts. He really, really gets in there, into that part, no pun intended. But at the same time, I think this is a very important film about the powers of bureaucrats and the way that power can corrupt and how people are subservient to authority figures, which is particularly interesting when you consider the fact that he was this acclaimed artist who was actually murdered, possibly in part because of this film, which I think sort of puts a stamp on the entire thing. It's also just aesthetically, it's fairly beautiful, which I feel funny saying because what's happening inside these sets and these environments it's not something I even want to describe, but everything else around it is so lovely, which I think reinforces a lot of thematic ideals about, again, the corruption that power can bring. So I give it a total recommendation, but do not watch it on a full stomach. I would say. Because there were moments where I honestly thought like I was going to vomit.
Okay.
Which I can never say about films, but in this instance. Yeah.
It's interesting how your film recommendations come with qualifications of what kind of physical state you have to be in.
Yeah.
Not a film to be watched when tired. Not a film to be watched when full. Not a film to be watched during the consumption of alcohol.
Mm.
Yeah, I also kind of think I'm generally pretty good about stomaching movies, but everything I've heard about that one has just kept me away up until this point, but I'm sure I'll get to it.
I would say just dive in.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I said that I bought the film, and that was like 2 years ago. It's still in the wrapper. It's one of those things that's like, yeah, I want to see it. Not right now, though.
The thing is, it's insanely compelling. It's actually, believe it or not, sort of, it's almost entertaining, in fact.
It's almost entertaining.
Well, it reminds me of a Haneke film, and I think it's appropriate that he listed this. I think it's his fourth favorite film of all time in a Sight and Sound poll.
Okay.
Because it definitely feels like he saw this and was able to crib a lot of thematic ideals from it, and it's engaging in that same way.
So. Well, my film this week is actually from last week, because I didn't have any time to watch a film this week, which is sad. Sad realization. I'm going to be talking about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. This was one of my favorite films of 2011, and it remains so. I don't know why I would retroactively go back and start redoing top 10 lists, but if I did, this would still remain. Gary Oldman's performance is fantastic. I think that the way the film is edited is also pretty wonderful. And not only that, but the way that the story is... this is a movie where almost everything has already happened, and it's all about finding out what happened and why. Like, there's very little real-time action in this film.
Mm.
It's all retroactively sifting through the information available to come to the truth of the event and the occurrence. It's a very weird film to get in tune with if you're only used to seeing things that are like the Bourne movies that happen like completely in the moment. Someone has to get beaten up. Especially considering that the main character's primary power over everyone else in the film is his unflappability. And yeah, it's fantastic. It's got the stellar cast. The direction by Thomas Alfredson is fantastic. Yeah, I really don't know what else to say. It's just a fantastically well-crafted film.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that movie should have like walked away with every possible production design award on the planet.
Yeah,
I agree. Production design, editing, sound design. For some reason, every time I watch this film, I become engrossed in the sound, like the Foley work, like just a man spreading butter on toast.
Which is a really funny moment too.
Yeah. It's given a volume that's both humorous and vaguely threatening. It's just like, I don't get it. I don't understand why this film works this kind of voodoo that it does. And it's hilarious that I said butter on toast and everyone apparently knew what I was talking about.
It's funny because in the context of the scene, this is a man who is sort of being grilled about handing over this important information. And because he's the one who actually has the power, he's being such a prick about it. And he has that look on his face as he's spreading the butter on the toast.
And
you know what I'm talking about, because you just saw the film.
Exactly.
It's a wonderful moment. And I love that actor, too. He has that very dry British intonation, which makes him the perfect... conduit of that moment, I suppose.
Yeah. I would love to be able to say, as he does, like, to people... Like, if someone's like, what's wrong, and I say I won't talk to them, and if they ask me, like, why I won't talk to them... I would love to be able to say in his exact manner, you're a leaky ship, right? That would be so great.
That'd be a good skill to have.
That would be a great skill. That would get me so far in my like life and my job. I feel like I would be the CEO of my company in 4 months if I could just tell everyone that they were a leaky ship. Anyway, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, fantastic. There's a lot of really great things to hold on to after watching that film. So you should definitely check it out. But that is it for today, ladies and gentlemen. So, guys, let's tell them where they can find us online, and then we'll sign off. Nick, start off with you.
You're going to have to take 11 years to find me.
I'm going to give you one name. I'm going to give you one
name. Thanks, Danny, for that laugh.
Okay, so, Danny, where can we find you on the internet?
Thefilmstage.com. It's a movie website.
Oh, really?
KingBulletin.com. That's my... another movie website, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin, so social networking.
And Danny, I have one last question for you.
Yeah.
When was the last time you saw Nick Newman?
7 hours ago in a meeting about surveillance.
Shit. Anyway. God, we don't even have the excuse that it's really late at night to be this loopy. I think
it's too early. That's our excuse.
So what? We have to find our ideal operational time. I can be found online at thefilmstage.com. I can also be found at dearfilm.net, my personal site, and on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Nick, are you actually not going to say where you're at?
Oh, come on. You know at this point.
All right. You can find Nick at twitter.com/Nick_Newman. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and come back next week when we will be talking about something. We lost Nick, didn't we?
Yeah, this is weird.
Along with appearances from Chris Pratt, Joel Egerton, and Mark Duplass. You think Mark Strong's going to be mad that I didn't mention him?
Yeah.
He's going to walk in the room and hit his hands on the table.
He's going to yell at me. And Nick, what about yourself? Nick? Shit, am I...
Would you like me to go?
I'm sorry, I was muted. I kept saying your name, and I was like, shit, we lost him again. And then I looked, and I was like, shit. So yes, Nick, what are your thoughts on this? And when he's brought in later, you can kind of see the change that his character is overgone? That's not the word.
Undergone?
Anyway. Undergone, yeah. Jesus.
I suppose that's the opposite of overgone. I don't know what overgone would constitute.
I don't know what overgone...
Maybe they haven't changed?
You can see the change that his character is overgone. Overgone? Am I doing it again? Undergone.
Third time's the charm?
Good lord, man.